Hey, y'all, I got a question for you. What's a piece of gear that you maybe have unintentionally overlooked in your rig throughout the years? Well, for me, it's always been guitar cables. I figured, it just goes from the guitar to the amplifier or the guitar to the pedal board to the amp, and if one breaks, whatever, I'll just go buy another one. No big deal. Thanks to the fine folks at Runway Audio, though, I have finally seen the light. Runway Audio is based in Nashville, Tennessee, which is awesome for me because that's right down the road. But it's awesome for you as well because Runway has the best cable on the market. And what makes it the best, you ask? Well, it has the lowest capacitance of any cable on the market right now, at 20 picofarads per foot. And pretty much all that capacitance is the ability to store an electrical charge. The lower the capacitance is, the less tone that it sucks from your cable from your guitar on the way to your amplifier. So if you're in the market for anything cable-related, whether it's instrument cables, patch cables, XLR cables, speaker cables, power cables, you name it, Runway Audio has got you covered. And if you go down to my link tree, click the link for Runway Audio, any purchasing you will do, I will get a little bit of a kickback from that, which is always appreciated. So check out all the awesome stuff that Runway Audio is doing and pick something up to get the best tone possible. This episode today is brought to you by Stringjoy Guitar Strings, the finest strings on the market. For me, it has been the Orbiters that have been my absolute go-to ever since they have come out, and that's their coated electric strings. But if the coated thing's not your thing, totally get it. The Signatures and the Broadways in their electric line, top-notch quality. For acoustic guitars, they have their Naturals and their Brights, along with the Foxwoods, which are their coated Fosper Bronze. For all you bassists out there, too, they have the Signatures and the Rangers. Full disclosure, the link down below is my affiliate link, so if you would like to check out Stringjoy, click that link down below. Not only will you be getting the finest guitar strings on the market, but you'll also be helping out this podcast, which I greatly appreciate. So, head on over to Stringjoy today. I'm not even close to the tip of the iceberg of all the awesome things that Stringjoy does, so click the link down below and check them out for yourself. Welcome back to Man the Helm Podcast. Today I am joined by Jim Riley. Jim, how's it going, sir?
I'm doing great.
So I kind of have known about you, but not really have dove deep into what you have done as a musician. Mm-hmm. But one of the previous interviews I had was with Andy Wood, and he hit me with a phrase that has really permeated through me as a musician, was that Jim Riley is a complete musician. And that's one of those phrases that like really has hit me hard. Like, man, I got to do better. You know, that's one of those driving things of like, I have to be a complete musician, you know, and trying to figure out aspects of how to get there. You know what I mean? And yeah, with your experience and your background in education, it was like a no brainer. It's like, dude, I've got to talk to Jim. That was kind of the thought process.
That's great. You know? That's great.
So let's start at kind of like the genesis. Where did you grow up? How'd you kind of start getting into music? And we can just kind of progress from there if that's cool with you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I grew up in Natick, Massachusetts, which is right outside of Boston. I was born in Boston. I was raised in that area. It was a pretty musically rich environment. In high school, I actually had a really good jazz band I was in.
Oh, cool.
I played in a local band, and then I was taking lessons with a percussionist in the Boston Symphony. And so there's a lot of really good things. I was playing in a cool rock band that was, you know, playing out in Boston, and really musically rich. Graduated high school. Now, my band director had gone to North Texas, University of North Texas, where mm-hmm. I went. So he was the one who kind of turned me on to that place. And so I ended up going to North Texas, got my degree in music education there. And I mean, I think there's a lot of the journey of, you know, trying to be a pretty complete musician there in terms of, you know, getting to deep dive into some of the jazz stuff, some of the classical stuff, having some great instruction. And, you know, if there's anything that you want to kind of circle back to around there, we can certainly get into that.
For sure.
But yeah, so I graduated with a degree in music ed. I actually taught school for a year. And I realized that two things. I realized that I really liked it and that it was going to distract me from what my real goal was, which was to be a professional musician more on the performance side.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, flash forward a couple of years, I moved to Nashville in 97.
Okay.
And I was able to get pretty acclimated because I'd lived in Kansas City the 2 years before that. I had played a lot of country music and in this one particular dive bar there. That was probably as much of a influential education as my time at North Texas. And so getting to play all those real vintage country music songs and learning that stuff was really important. So when I came to Nashville, you know, I had long hair and I looked like a rocker, and but I knew the music, and they immediately recognized that. So I was able to get acclimated really quickly. I was playing a gig from 6 to 10 on Broadway at a club called Legends, which is right across from the arena.
Mm-hmm.
And the band leader had told me, he said, "Hey, there's this guy playing bass, Steve Ledford. You are going to love him." And Steve had just got the gig with Mark Chestnut, who's a country singer in the 90s. And long story short, Steve took me with him. And so I ended up with Mark Chestnut for 2 years. And that was a really great experience playing that popular country music, but more on the traditional country side of things.
Sure.
And all the while I was working with some friends of mine playing, you know, little $40 gigs in the clubs. And they got a record deal, and they asked me if I would be interested in touring with them. And I said, I am interested, but I want to hear your music. And because they and I both have mutual friends where some buddies of ours got a record deal and the music was horrific, you know?
Yeah.
And so I was like, I love these guys and I think they're really talented, but I want to hear their music. And, you know, from the very first moment of the first thing I heard, I was like, holy crap, this is unbelievable. And so I was like, yeah, whatever you guys are doing, I'm doing, man, I'm with you. So I'll give my notice with Mark. So that was me leaving an artist that had two buses and a truck,
right?
13 number one hits to go play with my buddies whose career might be over in 6 months. Mm. But I believed in them. I was young enough to make a mistake like that and feel okay about it. And so I did it, and that was Rascal Flatts. And we had a really nice 20-year run, touring and, you know, making records and doing amazing things. And it was pretty, pretty awesome.
Well, I mean, that's one of the things, kind of like a general overarching thing, especially in any creative field, whether it's music, art, or anything creative, you have to be able to take risks and say those yeses to those things that you're not completely sure about. Cause like you said, you left a very comfortable, pretty stable gig, relatively speaking.
No one in their right mind would do what I did.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's one of the important things to relay to people, because especially from my perspective of musicians at very low levels, it's that risk isn't there anymore, at least from what I've seen. You know what I mean? It's like, we want to find something that makes us comfortable enough to be able to do what we want to do, but we don't want to, the risk is where we advance in that sort of thing, you know?
No, in my career, that's definitely been the thing. You know, when I did move up to Kansas City for like 2 years, it was a long story, but basically there was a buddy of mine that Andy knows named Jeff Sheets. He's a guitar player, really great player. He was like, "Hey, you want to come up here and make a record with me?" And I was like, "Well, I'd never made a record." So I was like, "Yeah, sure." And so he said, "Well, are you interested in just doing some gigging?" So I went up there for a couple of years. That was a leap of faith, but not much. But the truth is when I moved up to Kansas City, I got really acclimated into the business there. I had a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah.
And I remember talking to one of the most prominent drummers still in Kansas City, who's a good friend of mine. And I said, I'm thinking about moving to Nashville. And he goes, terrible idea. And I'll tell you why. And he started to tell me, I went to Nashville and I was there for, you know, 2 years and I didn't have any gigs. And I came back here. He says, you're much better off here. He says, you're going to be able to carve this town up, you know?
Yeah.
And do great. And I went, yeah, I said, and I think the thing for people has got to be that if not moving is going to make them feel like they gave up on their dream or they just didn't pursue their thing, then I say you got to give it a try. But for me, it was definitely one of those things like, I mean, I never really considered the failure part, but I was like, I've got to do this. I'm compelled to do this. So coming to Nashville, you know, was something that I felt completely compelled to do. And I was going to make it work. And I was going to, you know, I was going to figure it out. Yeah. And then once I did, and I landed this, you know, really big gig with, you know, for me, this is like a pretty big mid-level artist, you know,
mm-hmm.
And everyone, no one told me at the time, but when I left Mark, everyone came up to me about a year or two later and they went, I thought you were crazy, man. He says, right. I couldn't believe you left yeah. Mark Chestnut to go play with Rascal Flatts. I mean, it sounds on paper, it's a dumb move, but I had already been looking for something that I felt like was going to give me a chance to advance. I wasn't the musical director or band leader over there. And I was never going to be, because the guy that's Mark's band leader is still his band leader. He's been his band leader for 30 years.
Right.
You know, Slim is his guy. He already had his guy.
Yeah.
I wanted to be in a situation where, you know, there was just more upward mobility and, you know, maybe the sky is the limit. And I had also missed the biggest glory days of Mark's career.
Sure.
And so I just felt like, man, I would love to be in a situation where, you know, I could ride, you know, and maybe, you know, get to the top of the mountain with some guys or girls or whoever. Cause I also auditioned for the Dixie Chicks. I told Gary, Rascal Flatts lead singer, I told him last night, I said, probably one of the best things that ever happened in my career was not getting the Dixie Chicks gig.
For sure.
Because if I'd have gotten that, then I wouldn't have been available
right.
for a Rascal Flatts. And I probably, if they'd asked me and I was playing with the Chicks, I probably would have said no.
Right. Yeah. You that know? Makes sense. Especially in that sort of time frame that you're talking about.
So, I mean, you know, taking those risks of moving to Nashville and believing in myself and leaving an established artist to go play with someone that's completely unproven just because you believe in them. Those were big risks. And I would say, you know, some of the other risks I took was, you know, writing my first drum set book. All three of my books, there was some risk there, but I mean, you know, I spent a lot of money on it and spent a lot of time on it. And I think it was only because of the quality and dedication of what I'd done that, you know, the book ended up being successful and I made all the money back and then, you know, and then some. I think that when I look at some of the parts of my career I'm most proud of, they all have something to do with, you know, taking a risk and, you know, putting myself out there.
Well, and with especially being a musician, you have to, what's the old adage? You have to be present to be known. You know, that sort of idea where if you're not around, and I mean, you could be one of the best players in the world, but if you're not out showing people and playing and gigging, it's going to be really hard for people to know who you are, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Especially from, you know, an off locality, you know, I mean, that was one of
Absolutely.
The things that, I mean, I knew that I needed to move to one of three places. And so I considered all of those places carefully. I looked at New York, I looked at LA, and I looked at Nashville. And I said, well, if I go to New York, and just knowing myself, I'm not a dedicated enough jazz player that I'm good enough to be on the level of those jazz players. Oof. So I'm not going to play jazz in New York. My skill set would have leaned me towards, because I have, you know, I have a broad understanding of styles and I can read and I can play other instruments. That would have led me towards Broadway and sure. doing the Broadway shows. And I just mm-hmm. looked at that and I went, that's awesome. And I've got friends that do shows there, a lot of them. It just wasn't what I felt like my path was. So I said, you know what? I'm going to leave New York alone. I looked at LA and I saw, like in New York, I saw a dwindling segment of the music business. Of course, the movie business was super thriving there, and there's a lot of movie music that gets made. But it was almost like the difference between Nashville and LA is that in Nashville, you can see the music business. You can see like the blood pumping through its veins.
Sure.
Literally, you can just walk yeah. to certain places and go, there it is. It's happening right there. And I felt like in LA, it's just all happening in secret places where nobody knows behind closed doors. And it's really hard to get, you know, put your finger on the pulse of it. And plus it's super expensive to live out there. And so I looked at my third option as being Nashville and going, I love the music I'm hearing out of there. There's a lot of opportunity there. Excuse me. And I just felt like, and I said, it's going to be cheaper to live while I'm not making it.
Sure.
At that yeah. time. So I was like, you know what? That's going to be the place for me. And so, yeah, that was this decision I made. And I know that it was the right one for me, for sure.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things you really have to consider in weighing all those options. And especially for you as an individual, what city is going to be the most beneficial for what specifically you want to do? You know, mm-hmm. if for instance, like you said, with the New York thing, you know, more of a Broadway sort of thing, if that's what really, really appeals to you, and that's the style.
And I like that stuff.
Absolutely.
But it just wasn't, I just didn't feel like that was the purest form of my childhood vision.
Sure.
Of what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
I wanted to, you know, play big stages. I wanted to play, you know, I'd be on the Tonight Show. I wanted to play in arenas. I wanted to ride a tour bus. I wanted to do all that stuff.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's like one of the things that I've noticed with I've met a handful of people. I've kind of just kind of shoehorned my way back into the music side of things after getting out of the military. Well, I obviously didn't have a whole lot of time to pursue that sort of stuff while I was in.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that I have noticed, especially from people that are my age or younger, in about their mid-30s to early or late 20s, is I keep hearing the same phrase over and over again. And I really wanted to kind of get your opinion on it. The oversaturation aspect of musicians in those local or those cities, those specific three cities in general, you know what I mean? And how hard it is to kind of push your way into that sort of environment. I don't really see it that way because I think that's just a mental block that you're putting in your way. Because the way I've always looked at it at musicians, and I've said it multiple times, is I mean, even a sample size of the United States, like how many people actually play an instrument in the United States? It's not very many relative to the population of the United States. And then how many people are actually using said instrument to go and perform for people? That's an even smaller, you know, portion of people. And then when you start getting up these higher tiers, this it just starts closing down and down and down. And it might seem like, yeah, it's really hard to get to the top of the mountain, but it's not hard to get to the base of the mountain. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard. It's
sure.
hard.
Yeah.
But it's not impossible. It's
yeah.
not impossible for anybody. You know, when I talk to young players and new players, and I just had a guy hit me up on Facebook Messenger, which any of you could do, by the way. I'm on Facebook, I'm on Instagram. You can find me pretty easily. Go to my Instagram first, Jim Riley, I think it's Jim Riley Music.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
that's what it is. Yeah. But that's a good place to find me. And I'm very accessible. And if you've got any questions, I will answer them. But I just got hit up by a guy the other day, yesterday, and he was like, hey, I'm new in Nashville and I'd like to talk to you, maybe take some lessons, which I do all the time with people. But even just the talking to part, You know, the thing that I try to tell all of them is, you know, when I moved to Nashville in 1997, everybody said the same thing to me. They said, boy, you missed it, because in the early 90s, it was just unbelievable here. And they were right, because the early 90s was Garth Brooks and Alan Jackson and Reba McEntire absolutely exploding onto the scene.
Absolutely.
I mean, Garth Brooks later in that decade was literally the biggest thing in the world. He was what Taylor Swift is now.
Right.
You know, he was it. And he came out of country music. So people were saying, well, you really missed it. And I didn't miss it at all. And I think people say that, you know, you can say that about real estate. You could say that about the stock market. You could say that about Bitcoin or whatever it is that you're looking at. You know, in general, and this is just a little financial tip, the best time to buy is in the past.
Sure. Yeah.
And
yeah.
The worst time to buy is in the future. Yeah. So, you know, whether you're looking at the stock market, that's true. If you're looking at houses, that's true. You know, I mean, you can try to time things up and down, but if you're waiting for like a crash that's going to, you know, move everything to 50% of what it was, it's, you know, it's unlikely it's going to happen how you want it to. So there's always opportunities for new players. If you are a focused player, that you understand the assignment, you know, what our job is as a musician, what your job is as a drummer in my situation. And if you understand what the assignment is, what people are looking for, the fact that you have to be, no matter what instrument you play, you have to be a very complete musician. It's not about just playing the instrument. You have to understand music itself. You have to understand how music is built in terms of like the things that we've all heard with the intros and verses and choruses. Well, not all songs are built that way. There are other formats. You have to understand and recognize and be able to analyze that and know what the song needs from you. And then do that, you know, with great quality of sound and great timing. And if you can do that and throw a great attitude on the top of it, and add a sprinkle of persistence, you know, you're probably going to have a pretty good chance of making it.
Yeah. So I kind of wanted to talk about the teaching aspect. I've been teaching at a local mom and pop shop up in Hopkinsville, Kentucky, mostly guitar. And that's one of the key things that I've really tried to focus in on my students that are getting out of that beginner phase into that intermediate mm-hmm. phase. You know, of like, okay, so now we're going to take the foundational knowledge that you already know, so we have an awesome baseline to work off of, and we're going to talk about just being more than a guitar player. You know what I mean? Like how we're going to sit and listen when we're playing with bands, how we're going to sit and think about like a composition of a song if we're trying to write something. You know what I mean? We're not just going to sit mm-hmm. here and say, okay, well, I'm going to use the major chords, so I can use these seven, and I might do it in this particular cookie cutter order that I'm going to utilize for all my songs. You know what I mean? Like we're going to sit here and really try to analyze the musical aspect of being a guitar player in that specific circumstance. You know what I mean? So whenever yeah. you're teaching new students or when you get to that like intermediate, where they're kind of breaking out of that beginner level where they have that baseline foundational knowledge, how do you usually proceed with them from that? I know it's different for every individual, but.
It's really interesting because when I teach, I mean, I teach at all levels right now. I mean, I have beginners, I have intermediates. I teach at Belmont University in Nashville. So mm-hmm. I'm teaching college students. I'm teaching young pros. And I'm teaching, you know, older hobbyist type players that just want to get better. So I really run the gambit, you know, in terms of like the types of players. And also in the level. I mean, I've got some players that are really incredibly good. And I've got some players that are, you know, pretty new. And it's interesting that they all need basically the same stuff. It's just, you know, like one of the things that I focus on is just is fundamentals. Mm-hmm. Just having a fundamental technique so that you can properly express yourself. And the joke that I would tell about that is, you know, beginners need fundamentals. Intermediate players need their fundamentals reinforced, And advanced players need to be reminded what fundamentals are.
I couldn't agree more. I could not agree
yeah,
more.
You know, because they start to get away from that.
Yeah.
And so, sometimes I'll do these drum camps here, and I can have beginners, immediate, intermediate, and advanced all kind of drinking from the same trough, because I'm trying to convey all the same basic stuff to them. At Belmont, a lot right now, I'm really focusing on, we listen to a piece of music, and I let them listen to about half the song, and I say, okay, what's the form? And they go, huh? And I go, what is the form of the song? If you don't know what the form is, then you can't properly service this song. And whether it's a 12-bar blues, or whether it's what we would call an AABA format, which basically means you have a section, and you have another section just like it.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have a new section, and then you have the first section again. And that's one big package that keeps happening over and over.
I see. Yeah.
That is a format that we call AABA format. That's one form that there is. So I'll run them through basically like a questionnaire in their head to try to help them understand what the form is. And if they understand, or whether it's a pop song, whether it's got intro and verse and chorus and bridge and all that stuff. If it's that, then, you know, I've got certain things that I'm saying here are some default settings you can throw in terms of, like, you know, the orchestration around the drum set. You know, for those who aren't musicians and they're glazing over here, it's basically the idea of just, we're playing chess when everyone else is playing checkers. I'm trying to make sure that my students understand to the highest degree, you know, what the music is that they're playing so that they can better serve it.
Exactly. And I really want to emphasize that those two words is serving, or that phrase, I guess, three words, serving the song. You know what I mean? That's one of the biggest things I've noticed, especially with younger guitar players, is they're especially these days, because they have YouTube and all the other social media aspect of it, where they see people just shredding away, going crazy, but they have no concept of what they're actually doing when they're learning these insane lines. You know what I mean?
Well, the most annoying thing about, and you know, I get it on the drum side, and I'm sure you get it a lot on the guitar side, is a lot of the clips are missing context.
Yes.
So if you hear some crazy or and there's no context, then to me, it's worthless. The third book that I wrote was a book called Improvisational Tools for the Modern Drummer. And basically, it just goes through different patterns. I could show you guys a pattern that everybody here would understand. If I play two on my hands, two on my foot. So I go two here. And so even if I'm showing them that, I'm going to do that in the context of coming out of a groove and going back into a groove. Because if you don't have that, then it's just this piece of language that you don't even know how to use.
Right.
And so that was kind of one of the basic rules when I wrote that book in my mind, was everything's got to have context. And so when I see, you know, these examples, and it's just like, you know, a series of, you know, 18 hands and foot stickings, and then I hear them demonstrate it, and I'm going, that's not even in a phrase. It's just, I'm going, I just don't understand how people would see that as helpful, but I don't know that that's the main objective on a lot of the social media thing. I think it's, unfortunately, it's more about, you know, it's more about clicks.
Absolutely.
And yeah. I think that in some ways, maybe the fact that some of the stuff is frustrating is intentional.
Sure.
Because then if they get the negative attention, that's almost more valuable than the positive attention.
Absolutely. Well, and most people know that I don't want to say most, when it comes to the social media thing, and we're sitting here trying to validate ourselves by a number, it doesn't mean anything. You know, there was a
Yeah.
it doesn't matter really who's watching your videos, but if people start watching your videos that you like and respect and really actually want to do it, that's what matters. The
Yeah.
random people that you have no idea, if that's your thing, if that's what you're doing is putting stuff out on social media, you know, the subscriber count or the click rate or whatever you have, that doesn't matter. It's the audience that you're trying to connect with, and if that's who you're reaching, that's awesome. If it's the people that you're not, it's not that big of a deal.
Yeah. I had accidentally, so I have a newer Facebook account right now. I think the one I have now is Jim Riley Nashville or something like that. Well, the old one I had like 20,000 followers,
Okay.
which is kind of a lot, I guess, you
Yep.
know. It got hacked, some
Okay.
hacker in
Yep.
Milan, and I don't have it anymore. It still exists, but I don't have it. But so I've started over. I've got a new one, and you know, I've got 2 or 3,000 people. But the truth is I don't know that I was ever going to get back up to 20,000 because I'd had a couple of very accidental viral posts,
Sure.
and those viral posts didn't really have a lot to do with, like, say, the music career that I'm trying. One of them, you know what it was about? Is the craziest thing. It was about finance.
Yeah.
I'd posted something about my car. I drive, and I still drive it. I just got out of it. A 2004 Toyota Corolla.
There you go. Yeah.
I think it's a great car. I
Yeah.
love it. I think, and it actually looks great. And you know, I don't apologize for it. So I had just at the time gotten a body shop to buff out the headlights, because we always know that like the thing that makes our car look the oldest is those old looking headlights, right? So they buffed them out. They looked really great. So I posted about it. I said, hey, my local body shop, you know, did a great job buffing these out. Now it made my car look. And I started getting a couple of these. Whoa, wait a second. Are you telling me the drummer for Rascal Flatts drives a 2004 Corolla? And I went, okay, let me get into this a little bit. So I started to break it down. So I started another post. And that's the post that went crazy. And it was basically just about financial responsibility and understanding, you know, that no matter how much money you make, you still have to live within a certain means. I mean, you could be making $5 million a year, and if you're spending 10 million a year, you're not going to be in very good shape for very long. I've always tried to live within my means. I have a pretty healthy retirement account. I own my house outright. You know, I have rental properties, one of which is a cabin in the Smokies.
Oh,
But
nice.
I only tell you that to say that I've done things with my money that I feel like are more financially responsible than putting them into a depreciating asset like a car. I
Sure.
just don't have, for me, I just don't see a lot of value in that. I don't subscribe to any trappings that I have to drive something that everyone thinks is awesome. Just like you know, when I play with Rascal Flatts and when I'm playing now with Gary LaVox, lead singer Rascal Flatts, I just played two shows with him this weekend. I wear headphones, and I've had people say, "Oh, I wanted to wear headphones," but people, you know, said, "Oh, hey, you shouldn't wear headphones because it doesn't look good." I'm like, "Whatever, man. I'm going to do what I'm going to do. I'm going to have to, you know, I'm going to do it my way. And if that's not, you know, good enough, but fortunately for the people that I've worked for and with for the last 25 years, they were fine with it."
Well,
So,
yeah, I kind of want to hit on that last little bit too, because every person that I've talked to or I've met that has had any success in any creative endeavor has said similar things to, I'm going to be authentic to myself and I'm going to keep pushing forward. When you start trying to kind of please other people and kind of do what other people you think other people want you to do, people will start to see right through that. It's just a ruse that you're kind of just kind of pulling over people's eyes a little bit. You know what I mean? But being honest and authentic, especially as a musician, you know, there's no reason not to be. Like you said, even something as silly as wearing headphones. Who cares who if you wear headphones or not? You know what I mean? But I think that's one of the trappings that I'm seeing with a lot of my younger students too these days is they're seeing that thing off of social media. Well, this went viral and this kind of playing style is what I need to try to achieve. It's like, well, if that's what you want to achieve, awesome. But don't think that you have to do this thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I think if I was talking to, you know, young players and they asked me, you know, what was my greatest assets as a player, I would say my passion and love for playing was the first one, and my clarity of purpose is my second one. So just hitting on the first one, I love playing music. I love playing music for a living. I understand there are people that like maybe a certain genre, like maybe they're really into jazz, or maybe they're really into metal, or maybe they're really into blues, or maybe they're really into country. I don't know. I'm into all of those things. I think they're all great. But I don't love any genre more than I love playing music for a living. In other words, there's nothing that I'm going, I only want to play this music. I love them all. I love playing music for a living. And so for me, coming to Nashville and playing country, which is new to me. I grew up in Massachusetts. I wasn't born with country music. I didn't understand country music. The only country music I heard, you know, in our perspective was I heard Dolly Parton, Kenny Rogers, you know, because not because they were country singers, but because they were pop icons.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and so then I, you know, they kind of snuck, you know, some country music, and I was like, oh, Gambler, word, that's great. It's this is really cool stuff, you know. And I listened to his records, and you know, later met him, you know, when we played on the Oprah show, and he was on that show, which was really cool. And then we opened up for him. We opened up for him in 2000, early in our career. And I just remember going out there and going, wow, this is super cool. But you know, my passion for playing, I love playing. I love playing for a living more than I love any particular genre. And I feel like one of the greatest things about that for me is that my passion is infectious to the other players that I play with. I, especially working with artists, I've become really sensitive to the fact that I don't know what their situation is. I don't know what their life is. And all I know is when I get up on stage, I want to have enough energy for me and for them, so that if they're zapped because they've been giving interviews all day on like this, but all day, you know, they've been doing this for 5 hours to promote their new record or something, you know, I want to feel like I've got them covered in that area, and I'm like bringing energy to the excess energy to the situation. Absolutely. And I feel like that the people that I've worked for the most, you know, appreciate the energy that I bring. And I feel like the second thing, the clarity of purpose, is just understanding what my role is, you know, musically and professionally, and understanding the assignment and really, you know, putting my all into getting that right, whether it be, you know, as a musical director, and just making sure that I'm doing everything to make sure that the musicians are as prepared as they possibly can be. I'm always working with high level professional musicians, but sometimes because I've got such a perspective on this music with Rascal Flatts and now with Gary, that I literally know this music probably better than all of them. And so okay, you know, and we're not using any tracks out with Gary. So I could say, hey, you know, this intro feels a little weak. I know you're playing the signature line in two bars, but the first two bars, if you'll give me some diamonds at the top and then go into that signature line, that would be super helpful. And then if you can switch with the other guitar player to that, that will work. And you know, we were doing that in rehearsal in sound check yesterday.
Nice.
And then as well as like cleaning up a double lead line between the banjo and the guitar.
Okay,
I'd
yeah.
heard something. I said, "Hey, let's clean that up," and slowed it down, and just started, you know, approaching it like we were in music school. I said, "Okay, let's take it right here, nice and slow," and then found the wrong notes and corrected it. And then it made, for me, I think it really made a big difference in the show.
Yeah. Well, it's at that high of a level, I would assume that it's the small nuance things that most, I guess, generally speaking, people wouldn't think about that are really going to make that experience in that show that much better.
Yeah, because I mean, I'm dealing with such great high
Right.
level professional musicians that, you know, I mean, you know, the fir we played two shows this weekend. The first one had some problems. And so, you know, rather than some of them were technical beyond our control
Sure,
and
sure.
others were more controllable. So, I mean, when I got to my second sound check of the week, I was like, oh, you know, I'm going to make sure and address those things because I want it to be better every time. I care. And I think that that care, that passion is something that gets translated to the people that I work for. And they know that if they put it in my hands, it's done. It's they don't have to worry about it anymore.
Absolutely.
And that feels good for me.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's one of the things I kind of want to harp on again, because it's just what I haven't seen a whole lot of it, at least locally to me, is serving that song or serving that artist. If you're working with somebody, you know, trying to figure out, like you said too, bringing that energy for them, really pushing hard to make sure that they feel motivated. Because like you said, you don't know what that individual's being gone through. Even like some smaller people at my local level, you know what I mean? People that go and do those just acoustic guitar gigs just by themselves for a couple, you know, days in a row, they might be completely shot and just burn out for the weekend, you know what I mean? And for you to be able to come together with a full band and really push that artist or that singer, whoever it is, to kind of really be motivated for that big full band sort of show, it helps out so much. And that positive attitude is what I try to instill in a lot of the students that are trying to kind of take that instrument the next level. It's like, always be honest with yourself and with everybody you're with, and try to achieve to be as best as you can at that current moment. You know what I mean? You want to play the best you, if you're going to go play a show, that you need to attempt to play the best that you have ever played for that show every single time. Every night you're showing up and you're just killing it, you know?
Yeah, for sure. You know
And
what's interesting with guitar players, because I know you're a guitar player. What I've found over the years is there are some people that are really good at being a lead guitar player, and there's some people that are better at being like secondary. I look at like the model of like AC/DC,
okay,
you
yeah.
know, where you got, you know, Malcolm and Angus, you know. And those are two really different things. And when you're playing with a group like Rascal Flatts, the textures are so deep that you have to be willing, you know, you need someone that's willing to not be the hero. They
For
are
sure.
definitely like what I would call like a blocking tight end. They're not going to catch passes. They're on offense. You know, but they're playing a lot of arpeggiated guitar parts and with effects, and they're, you know, never playing the guitar solos. Someone else is doing that, and that's a special talent. And the other thing is, for guitar players that are looking to make themselves more useful, is picking up a couple of other instruments, getting so that you feel really good on acoustic, maybe learning to pick up a mandolin, or at least, if not a banjo, like a ganjo, you know, and starting to feel comfortable. I've seen a couple of really incredibly high level professionals in Nashville kind of go, you know what? I am not going to be Brent Mason. So, you know, I'm not going to be the top picking guitar player in Nashville. So what if I focused my efforts on, you know, trying to be the person who can play all of the different utility type instruments. And I've seen some people focus on that and get really successful. And there are people that can do both, but it's definitely something to look at. You know, when you look at yourself as a player, you go, yeah, you know, when I hear that song, am I just always analyzing the lead and never listening to the other guitar parts? Or, you know, am I spending time on just making sure I've got a really great groove, making sure that I understand, you know, these secondary type parts, and, you know, that I would be willing to do those and happy to do those, mm-hmm. you know, because that's a lot like being a drummer. I mean, you know, I used to think, you know, I'm, you know, as the drummer, I'd be like, yeah, I'm almost like the quarterback. You know, it's like I touch the ball on every play. You know, I'm calling the shots. I'm doing all this stuff. And I'm going, wait a second. I'm not getting quarterback press. I'm not making quarterback money. But I touch the ball on every play. And frankly, they only mention my name when I screw up. I'm not the quarterback.
Yeah.
I'm the center. Right? You know, now the center's an important person, but, you know, if you're the center, you have to be okay with the fact that you may never score a touchdown.
Sure.
You may never touch a live ball past getting it to the quarterback. So we've got to be comfortable with our roles. Myself as a drummer, I love playing time. I relish the idea. I really enjoy playing time. And I think whether you're a guitar player, a bass player, or a drummer, I think if you enjoy playing time, then you will have a much improved experience as a professional or growing, you know, musician. You know, the solos are fun. And even as a drummer, you know, last night I've got a solo in the show, and, you know, it's about 8-bar solo, pretty cool. And I've got a chance to kind of stretch out and do some things every night. But I mean, honestly, that's not even close to my favorite part of the show. My favorite part of the show is probably, you know, playing a song like What Hurts the Most, because I like our arrangement. I think we got a really cool arrangement going.
Absolutely. Well, I think it kind of harps back to the social media thing about, you said, with no context, you know what I mean? We think of these lead lines and stuff like that. The ones that get stuck in your head, or the rhythms that get stuck in your head, are usually the most musically appealing to a general audience. You know what I mean? It's something that, mm-hmm. that hook that you just hum, you know, that's what you really need to be trying to write. At least in my opinion, the flashy solos are just the stuff like the little the tricks and stuff that we as guitar players can add to an already well-written melody that we're playing, or a well-written harmony that we're kind of weaving in and out of with different chord structures and stuff like that. The flashy stuff is awesome, and other guitar players will appreciate that. Other people will appreciate that. But at its core, I've always thought about when I'm composing is this going to get stuck in someone's head? Is this mm-hmm. line going to get stuck in someone's head? Am I going to be humming this 2 hours from now? You know what I mean?
Yeah,
that sort of idea.
Speaking of which, you know, our mutual friend, Andy Wood's record, you know, will be coming out fairly soon. And I think that was a really big thing for him in terms of his maturation as an artist. I think, you know, in the beginning, I think he felt like he was just like, I am just going to just shove this down everyone's throat. I can do this. I'm hard. I'm a metalhead, and I'm also a country guy. But it was really hard. Yeah. And I think now, like on this record, and I think that maybe this is why I ended up being a good choice to play drums on this record, was just because it was really much more about more song-ish things and more melodic things. And, you know, he was trying to write melodies that he felt like people were going to remember. So
yeah.
For all you guitar players, Andy Wood's new record is going to be coming out pretty soon. And I would give it a listen.
Absolutely. Well, before we wrap this up, let's get, I'm trying to do this thing where I'm talking to people, and this can be a broad general overview of just an idea that you have, because I think that really helps out a lot of people is, you know, whenever you're kind of hitting that rut in that creative field, what is something that you do to kind of get yourself out of? Because I know everybody goes through that sort of stuff, especially musicians. You know what I mean?
Well,
So,
you know, I think with drummers, it's a little bit of a mindset.
okay.
You know, I see people and they'll be like, are you tired of playing, you know, the same fills? You know, it's like you need, you know, new. And I don't know that it's as much about the idea that you need new fills, is that it's more that you need to be comfortable with what our role is. The number one role of a drummer is to keep time. I think, you know, aside from that, you know, I want to be able to frame out the sections.
Yep.
And as I'm framing out the sections, I'm using time, you know, orchestration, which means whether I'm on the hi-hat or I'm on the ride somewhere, I'm riding on the crash or whatever. But the other thing is that when you're playing fills, to make sure that your fills are a timekeeping endeavor, whether you're playing on guitar or drums, I guess. Anytime you're playing a fill, you got to make sure that there's just as much good quality timekeeping happening when you're doing that. And I guess the mindset when you feel like you're getting into a rut, the rut is that, you know, you feel like, you know, that what you're doing is boring. But I think when you go back to what you were talking about, which is, you know, the idea of serving the song, you know, you really do have to have the heart of a servant and just know that, like, you know, I mean, in this, in my basement, I've probably recorded 1,000 songs in here just since 2017,
Oh, wow. Yeah.
you know, and every one of those songs, I treat them like it's the most important song that I'm ever playing. And so I don't get bogged down by the fact that this song is the same as that song and kind of the same as that song. And you almost start to look forward to the ones that are kind of almost crappy and weird because at least they're different.
Right.
But honestly, I love trying to elevate music and make the clients like just happy beyond their wildest dreams. They go, you know, it was like with this logo right here, this Drum Dojo logo up there. My idea for the logo just sucked so much more, but I gave it to a professional and they came back with that. And I went, holy crap, that's super awesome. And it was so much better than I could have thought it was going to be. And that's what I try to do as a drummer. And if you feel like you're hitting walls in your development, you know, my two biggest pieces of advice will be to listen more, listen outside of your usual genre. If you're always listening to jazz, listen to some rock. If you're always listening to rock, listen to some metal. If you're always listening to metal, listen to some country. If you're listening to country, listen to blues, listen to jazz. Find some new inspiration. As a musician, you're always going to find more opportunities the more things that you qualify yourself to be able to do. So learn to play other genres. And always remember the second thing is that always continue to work on your fundamentals and make sure that your hands, and in our case with our hands and feet, are in the synaptic ability to be able to play whatever it is that, you know, your mind can dream up. So just make sure that your hands and your body is able to, and that's you really have to look at your fundamentals there. Make sure you're using fundamentally sound technique on your instrument, and that is also a lifelong endeavor.
Absolutely. Well, what's kind of on the horizon? Maybe we can talk about the next year for you. What do you got going on?
Oh man. So I'm still teaching at Belmont University. I enjoy that. Got Andy's record coming out. I just did a live EP with Gary Lavox, lead singer of Rascal Flatts. And, who knows? I mean, maybe it's possible at some point, Rascal Flatts will get together and do something. Like they say in baseball, they say there's always next year.
Right.
It's could be. So I don't sit and pine for that, but I feel like there's a lot of unfinished business there, and I would be excited to do that. And I'm just going to continue to hone my recording craft here, recording songs for people. If you need. You could actually afford me. I'm very reasonable. So if anyone out there is looking for drum tracks for something, you can also hit me up on Instagram, and I do that. And like I said, I'm shockingly cheap. Mostly because for the same reason with my educational endeavors, I don't want to price out the people that I want to work with. I could easily say, as an educator, I'm going to charge $250, $300 for a lesson.
Sure.
And then at that point, I would only have doctors and lawyers taking lessons with me.
Absolutely.
So, I try to, keep my rates reasonable so I can connect with musicians that want to connect with me, and not just the rich ones, but the everyday ones. So, yeah, I'm going to keep doing that, and I think I'm continuing to bridge the gap between, my educational endeavors and bringing as much as I can of that online. And that's obviously a really important thing in today's market. A lot of stuff has gone online, and there's a lot of junk online, and there's a lot of really great things online. And so I want to try to, be one of the good influences out there.
Absolutely. Well, Jim, I really appreciate it. I'll have all your links down below as well. If you guys are drummers, I'll have the survival guide for the modern drummer, the improvisational tool for the modern drummer down there as well as the song charting made easy. I'll link
Yeah,
down
which is the
below.
national number system.
Yep.
If you're a musician of any kind, guitar player, keyboard player, bass player, drummer, the national number system's incredibly helpful,
Yeah.
and is becoming more and more used all over the place. I have a pretty cool book on the subject, which you can also Google that and look at some YouTube. There's actually some pretty good YouTube links on that as well.
Awesome.
But that's a really great system. And yeah, you can pick that book up on Amazon if you're interested.
Awesome. Well, Jim, I really appreciate you taking the time, man.
Absolutely. Well, this has been really great. I wish you luck, and I hope to chat with you again another time.
Absolutely. Well, for all of you and for Jim, we're going to go ahead and wrap this up and we'll check you guys next week on Man the Helm Podcast.